Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jason.
And today we are kicking it old school. It's just the originals, the two of us. And we are here.
Just a wee. No chaff.
No chaff. And we are here to talk about the tragedy of the American Socialist Movement.
Yeah.
So, Jason, you are our resident expert in the subject, by virtue of the fact that you know more about this than I do, and there's no one else here. So, why don't you start us off with the origins of the American Socialist Movement?
Sure. Yeah, so I guess the first thing I want to say, though, is that there's a good reason to be just going through a very rough and incomplete crash course in U.S. socialist history. Partly, the first one is that the family tree, if you draw it out on a chart, and I have, is very complicated.
I've seen that chart.
And it's a head-spinningly complex, and it really helps you feel like everything is a mistake. The second thing is that I think that we often presume that we are the inheritors of traditions because we like certain ideas.
Right.
And in fact, I think that a close examination of U.S. socialist history shows that actually there are distinct trends on the left that are rooted in, you know, material circumstances and practice that regardless of the way in which you change the language and the terminology and just the way that people speak from basically cultural period to cultural period, that they're really distinct. There's like a proletarian socialist movement, and then there's a non-proletarian socialist movement. And I have the contention that the contemporary left is, whatever it thinks of itself, largely descended from the latter and not the former. And then the third...
Yeah, that's it. That would be pretty evident, I think, to anyone who thought about it for a few minutes.
Yeah, it's true, right? It's like it's on the surface, but I think we often have conversations... and I say we in the broad collective we, trying to answer the question, how do we reconnect or get back to, you know, the working class? And I would say we are the inheritors of a tradition which did not start with the working class, by and large. So that's something, that's a claim that I think is a bit bold and bears some investigation. And the final reason to me is that, generally speaking, we look back on a period like what we call the long 60s, you know, it begins in the late 50s and ends in the mid 70s, that kind of big wave of radicalization that encompasses everything from civil rights to the anti-Vietnam War movement to the Days of Rage and the Weathermen, and the high point of American Trotskyism is all this kind of last really great period, golden age in American left history. Whereas I sort of think of it as actually the beginning or even really the midway point in a decline. So I would actually suggest that from 1870 to now, we have seen one distinct period of a rise in the movement and another distinct period of a decline in the movement. And we still exist in that declining period. Or at least if we are on the other side of that decline, it is not yet clear. There is no evidence that we are. So maybe a more trained historian might have a way to, I think, quibble with some of the details in here. But I do think that there's a political set of claims that can be made about these things. And that's...
Well, I think that, like, we might be at the end of the decline, but now it's like we've basically devolved from, like, multicellular, like, organisms, from primates back down to, like, primordial stew. Yeah. So we're in primordial stew stage right now. Maybe we're hoping that we'll get struck by lightning, or amino acids will be created by like waves on a rock. I don't know.
Yeah, you know how evolution happened.
Yeah, like a panspermia, like an asteroid will land from outer space with organisms on it that will evolve into something.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's what we're hoping for.
I think
space socialism. We're Posadists.
We are Posadists now. It's about time we came out.
Yeah.
I think that we have done I don't know if we've done a good job, but we have done a lot of a job of lamenting the post 60s inheritance in American socialism. And so I think, you know, we have almost, well, let's say we rarely have talked about everything prior to that, other than just to say, we once had a socialist party, we once had a communist party, we once had a trade union movement. So in a less than exhaustive way, maybe we can just dig into some of that and connect some of the dots. And I guess that's the point.
Okay.
The point here.
Dots time.
Dots time. So I guess the first thing is that the socialism in the U.S. is old as hell, and it's as old as it is in Europe. And I think that for people who just haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, that's a surprise. It goes back to the if you want to think just in terms of the religious utopian commune building millenarian tradition, it's an early 19th century philosophy. But even as a industrial philosophy, it goes back to basically the end of the Civil War and the sort of the crack up of the Republican Party and anti-slavery coalition as Reconstruction sort of settled a bunch of social questions and opened up a bunch of new ones. Namely, like that the Republican Party can't be the voice of the working class and also the voice of the industrialists who are building the railroads and expanding the factory system across the continent and proletarianizing the yeoman farmers, the artisan classes, and so on. So I think rather than try to find the precise origin point where, like, there is a core of people who are philosophically in favor of something we might recognize as socialism in a modern industrial sense, we could basically just trace the birth of the movement back to 1876, because that's when some German immigrants from the Social Democratic Party found their way over to the United States and founded basically a replica of their group called the Working Men's Party. And it's like half LaSallian and half Marxist. And it's the two warring wings of socialism came over here and started a new party and never resolved the differences. So you still have the revolutionary versus reformist debate, and it's kind of always been there.
Right. And now that was tragedy, and now we're living through the farce of that.
Oh, I don't know. Is there something deeper than farce? Is there some second tier, higher order of farce?
Travesty?
The Working Men's Party is a really interesting thing because it's like at their peak, they've got 60,000 members and they are super influential in the Great Railroad Strike, which is, I think, not at all inappropriately compared to the Paris Commune in terms of the armed and combative nature of the working class, including cities like St. Louis, which are essentially run by a general strike committee, which is staffed by not exclusively, but largely by members of the Working Men's Party. You know, the newspapers at the time all talked about the communist revolution in America, and, you know, they would draw dates like it would be 1871 Paris, 1876, and it would be like a whole series of cities up and down the main rail lines at the time. So that's like Pennsylvania, New York, West Virginia, Missouri. It's like four or five states, I forget. It's like 100,000 workers are on strike at this time. And the National Guard, who's president in 1876? It's not Grant. It's Rutherford B. Hayes.
1876.
It's Hayes, because Hayes is the great compromiser who ends Reconstruction and sells out, you know, basically all black people by removing federal
no.
troops.
It's Ulysses S. Grant.
Oh, it's Grant. Okay, well, you know, our characterization of Grant could be something like the
hold on
Mao's characterization of Stalin, right?
No, wait, you were right. It is Hayes becomes president in 1876. Grant is president for 10 days in 1876, and then Hayes is.
Okay,
so you're right.
So
you're right.
I mean, you know, whatever. Grant probably would have done the same thing, honestly. But Rutherford B. Hayes calls out the National Guard, also deputizes a bunch of private militias. I mean, he basically allows governors to do that, and that's what it takes to beat the strike. So that's like the coming out party of the American working class and American socialism. It's not a bad start. But there's also like this really peculiar, you know, this is just, I think it's hard for us to get our heads around. Ooh, we don't say that on this podcast. That's not what you do.
No, it's hard for us to rub it into our mind brisket.
Yeah, that there was this party was largely German speaking in the United States. So outside of the German-speaking communities, there weren't very many members of it. This is a different country than the one we live in today. And they become famous really only for this. And that's really the only other thing that they do besides split. Their most charismatic leader, their most famous leader is Daniel de Leon. He brings a lot of respectability and a lot of, you know, he speaks English. He's very well-read and intelligent. And he's also a terrible, awful sectarian. And everyone hates him. and, you know, Engels writes letters to the socialist movement in the U.S. that are just full of, I should have pulled one up. They're just full of, like, these terrible lamentations about the state of the movement. He's like, kind of just hopes the party goes away.
They didn't. They're still around, yeah. As far as I know.
Yeah, I don't know how many people are in the SLP, so they're the Socialist Labor Party, but it's got to be dozens. but they do something cool where they split and they merge with another group where Eugene Debs' group, which is trying to get off the ground. And that's where we get the Socialist Party of America.
Hold on. According to Wikipedia, the SLP began having troubles funding their newspaper, The People. So frequency was changed, and it didn't save the paper from collapse and was suspended in 2008. The online version ceased in 2011. And as of 2007, the party had 77 members at large, and they closed their national office on September 1st, 2008.
But it still exists, formally.
Yeah, I guess so.
Listen,
I can't believe they still had a national office as late as 2008.
I bet you that they got really, like, grandfathered in with, well, whatever, they probably bought the property outright back whenever you could still buy things in this country.
I bet you anything they owned an office space in New York City the way the SWP did, and they sold it for several $1 million.
That's what I would do. So that's the very quick prehistory. Right now we're in the early 1900s, and we've got the Socialist Party of America, right? It's the result of the split out of the SLP and the merger with Eugene Debs' group, which is called the Social Democratic Party. And, you know, we finally have the party that Engels tells Americans they need, which is a wide open, open-armed and open-minded party that seeks to represent the working class with all of its difficulties, all of its, all the problems it has, and, you know, doesn't require everybody to have a really specific line on everything. It's a funny thing to think about that being the first problem our movement's ever had, and it's still the main one we've got. I sort of think about this. It's a long period, right? It's like 24 years where the movement kind of like explodes onto the scene and then kind of slowly dies off and then is reborn. It's maybe something that if hope was in our lexicon, we should say it would give you a reason to be a little bit hopeful about the future, because 24 years is a long time. Of course, our decline's been longer than that.
But yes.
But the Socialist Party of America is, I don't know. I mean, I guess some people think of this as the model, and I guess I sort of do too, which is this is my first real heresy as an ex-Trotskyist, is I think the Socialist Party of America probably was what we needed. And I think maybe, I don't know, some version of it is still probably what we needed. Because the only thing you had to do is be a member, to be a member of the party is agree with its program.
Right.
And
I mean, I think that we've on this show talked a number of times about how we think that like broad agreement over a program is the way to move forward.
Yeah.
In building a socialist movement.
Yeah. Like maybe they were a little bit too wide open because, you know, they had like some people who
openly white supremacist members.
Yeah. They had some people who thought segregation was fine. They had some people who thought, you know, there were too many Asians coming to the West Coast. But
it had, yeah.
But I wouldn't say that those are defining features. Those are the debates of the labor movement at the time, and the Socialist Party at the time just reflected those. And the better people in the party were basically the same positions we have now. You know, Eugene Debs and Bill Haywood were. We should say that they were a little colorblind to a fault. You know, I think
right.
Debs had that famous quote that the Socialist Party has no special program for the American Negro worker, but only a program for the entire working class. And that's like a weird blind spot that they have for a long time. It actually takes the Russian Revolution and the intervention of the Communist International to make American socialists forge a politics around race as something that is experienced apart from class. But, you know, whatever. When I say that the Socialist Party of America is something like a model, it's not to say every idea they had. It's the organizational model.
Right.
And everybody knows the famous election where, there are two of them, where Debs gets like something like 1 million votes. You know, this is back when black people in the South can't vote, women can't vote, itinerant workers with no fixed address, they also can't vote. So that's like the Socialist Party base. It's like people who are timber workers and miners and, you know, a lot. They're basically the types of people who make up the IWW. are mostly not able to vote. So
right, there are mostly unskilled workers.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to think about to me. It's like if 900 and something and change 1,000 people vote for Debs, makes you really sit back and think about how popular the Socialist Party once was in this country. I forget which, I should have written these down, but there are a couple of elections where the only reason why the Socialists are beaten in the election is because the Republicans and Democrats run a joint ticket. So there's a brief period where it looks like you could see a new two-party system emerging of a Democratic, Republican, and Socialist. But I also think like there's some of the foolishness of today's left is also on display in this period too. Because maybe if they got away from the old De Leonist sectarianism of you just trying to take over everything and telling everybody who didn't understand them that they were enemies of the working class. So, like, obviously that sounds familiar. But in the Debs era, a similar sort of haughty attitude about the question of, like, farmers and, like, sharecroppers, people who aren't proletarians, the disappearing artisan layer. It's a really sad thing to think about. There was this massive, you know, we always talk about the populist movement. There's a period where there's a massive wave of agrarian radicalism, and the socialists just don't have anything to do with it because they see it as like the desperation of the declining middle classes. And yeah, that's true. But, you know, the Russian Revolution is based on the alliance between these two things. The Americans never figured this out. Also, one of the big questions about the socialist movement in this country today is why we're the only one that doesn't have a strong connection between socialism and the labor movement. And part of that's because they did it on purpose. Even the best people, right? They refer to, I think even Debs, I think this is where I heard this from. It's Debs referred to the two-armed labor movement. You get the unions and you get the Socialist Party, rather than thinking of them as the same thing, like they do in every other country. So, you know, you have a social democratic movement, a social democratic party, and a labor movement that are synonymous in Germany and even in the United Kingdom with the Labor Party and their trade unions. And for us, it's two separate things that are thought of as being allied to each other, but, you know, that there's a division of labor. So thinking about some of the problems of the SP at the time, there's the really, really famous debate about immigration, you know. We mentioned about the concern about too many Chinese people coming. That's a real debate in the party. And they have this three-way split. I forget. It's like 1910. So there's a right-wing position that basically is the AFL position of opposition to immigration from East Asia. And then there's a centrist position. This is basically the compromiser position, which is opposition to immigration of all unskilled laborers, which everyone knows is basically the same thing. And then the left-wing position is to just take the position that the role of socialists is to forge ties between all workers and that dividing them on any basis ever is always wrong. And so, you know, we always have that. But also the executive of the International, I guess it's called the International Socialist Bureau, is the executive of the Second International, sort of condemned the Americans for even having the debate. So we've been
for having the Angela Nagel debate.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's interesting to point out too that this is like long before there exists a thing such as National Bolshevism or Strasserism.
Yeah, this is just a current within socialism.
Yeah, it's a conservative current within socialism that's still socialist.
Yeah, and like nationalism is still entirely, you know, not synonymous with, but is entirely integrated into the socialist movement at the time. So like Edward Bellamy, who writes the book Looking Backward, is he founds a series of nationalist clubs. I don't know if that's important. The debate about immigration and the fact that it can kind of split three ways and that it's like not, you know, it's not super clear cut about what the appropriate position is something that I think maybe contemporary leftists might look back on and see us as being, you know, more advanced. And maybe that's true, but also we're in no way as powerful and in no way as connected to, and, you know, we're just, it's just not the same movement. This is a movement which is a movement of the working class, and the working class.
We're less racist, but we're dumber in almost every other imaginable way.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So, you know, the way that Trotskyist and Leninist history goes, all the various types of Leninisms, the way that that historiography goes is that this all gets resolved, right, during the First World War. So there's
right
repression of the party, and they're sort of driven underground. I mean, not really driven underground, but they're...
almost driven underground.
Yeah, I mean, like, they are... any illusions about getting, you know, incorporated into the mainstream of American life and just being the... This new two-party system, that starts to go away, right? Like, the whole Oklahoma organization basically ceases to exist, and that's one of the more important ones.
Which is super interesting to think about when you look at how solidly Republican Oklahoma is, to think that it was once a bastion of socialism.
Yeah, and before that, a bastion of the sort of populist radicalism.
Right, which populism, the populist movement, when it dies out, it's like a lot of its base go into... the movement for socialism.
Yeah. You know, actually, that's an important point, too, because there is no ex nihilo socialism here. We have a movement that has its origins going back to the Free Soil movement from before the Civil War, and it is constantly mm-hmm. absorbing and growing and changing and being changed by elements that go into it. So, you know, the utopian colonizers and trade unionists, and also the populists who are all these different kinds of radicals, but, you know, are in favor of agricultural cooperatives. So the movement's made up of all these different parts, so it's going to have a lot of different expressions. But anyways, First World War is a big deal. The Russian Revolution is sort of seen and is taught to us in U.S. left mythology as the big clarifying moment where the road forward is made very obvious, and that's to create a communist party and leave the right-wing reformist-oriented socialists behind. But the party actually splits into three pieces, and all three of them apply to join the Communist International, because no one's against the Bolsheviks, and no one was for the war.
Right.
Like, we're actually, like...
That's one thing that the Americans didn't have in common with the European Social Democratic parties, was that none of the American socialists were for the war.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, it's the Russians and the Americans are the only two parties in the International that just take an unequivocal anti-war position. There are a handful of pro-war socialists like John Spargo and Jack London, but they're the ones who leave the party. So,
yeah. Where does Jack London go after that?
Nowhere.
Nowhere?
I don't think he joins anything again.
He just writes books?
Yeah. He still considers himself to be a revolutionary socialist. He just also is really confused about the role of the American state in the world.
He's also kind of racist, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, actually a lot, even. Although he also acknowledges it later. I think what he says is something like he's a victim of his own time and that he's never been able to fully square with the prejudices he was raised with, but he also doesn't really do much to square with it.
Right.
What are we talking about? Right, okay, so yeah, the whole socialist movement is against the war, and it's for the Russian Revolution. So as the story goes, whenever you... at least the way I was taught this as a young Trotskyist, was that people like John Reed and Louis Freyne, both of whom go found their own socialist parties, their own communist parties, and then are eventually forced to merge by the Communist International, are making the right move, because you need to have an explicitly communist party. And after all, the Socialist Party executive kicked them out whenever they won elections to the executive. And they also kicked out 66,000 other people, basically two-thirds of the organization. But in the defense of the Socialist Party executive, they kicked out everybody who they knew was trying to split and create a communist party. So it's actually, to me, this is a great tragedy. This is a horrible moment in our history. It's like 1919 is the year where a whole bunch of people who actually agree in practice, but disagree in terms of like the precise language that you would use, basically shatters the movement into a bunch of pieces.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that was sort of the pinnacle of socialist unity in the United States is right before that point. And then ever since then, it's just been a series of smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller groups.
It's true. Like, you can draw...
I was going to say, well, there was a peak of some consolidation on a much smaller scale, but then back to fragmentation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like, you can, if you know, the chart goes, you know, if you started at 1876, you got a straight line with the Workingmen's Party turned SLP all the way to the present day. And you got a little branch out of that And you can add another line to it, and then now you have the Socialist Party. And then in 1919, you've got the communist branch that breaks off. And then from there on out, it's just branch after branch after branch.
Yep.
In an increasingly fratricidal conflict at an increasingly farcical level. But so, yeah, they form, right, the story goes, they win the election. The executive kicks them out. They also kick out everybody who agrees with them. So now you've got one section which forms the Communist Labor Party, one section that tries to go to the Socialist Party convention and take over, and they can't, so then they march down the street. No, they march downstairs in the same building and found the Communist Party of America. So now you have three parties, Socialist Party of America, Communist Party of America, and Communist Labor Party, and all three of them apply to join the Communist International. And that, to me, says all that needs to be said about what the real divisions are. And eventually, the Comintern forces the two communist parties to merge, and they have about 12,000 members, and the Socialist Party has about 12,000 members, and that means that something like 100,000 former Socialist Party members just disappear, just like drift off into the ether. And that's the real tragedy. You know, famously, Eugene Debs doesn't join the Communist Party, and he actually writes a really great article about how the communist press excoriates him for being a traitor to the working class, and maybe he's just not well-read enough to understand the nuances of the latest updates in the immortal science. But, you know, he knows that the Socialist Party has been the party of the working class, and so why should he leave? And a lot of people agree with him, so he gets another million votes, even from jail.
That's interesting. So one of the things I always learned as a young Trotskyist was, you know, we're supposed to simultaneously laud Debs for getting a million votes from jail and the communists for splitting from the Socialist Party.
Yep. And not endorsing Debs in his 1920 campaign either.
Right. That's interesting because I didn't know that. I always assumed that, yeah, I guess if I just looked at the dates, I would have figured it out. But I always assumed that the Debs getting a million votes happened before he was in, before the split.
Well, right. Because it happens in 1912 and also 1920. And so
does he get a million votes in 1920? He gets them twice.
Yeah. I mean, I think, hold on. I actually have this written down. It's not actually a million. It's 900.
Oh, it's like 900,000.
Yeah, it's 901,000 votes, which is 5.9% of the vote in 1912. And in 1920, it's 913,693, which is 3.4% of the votes. But that's with the party in utter shambles after wartime repression and splitting into three. And also with the communists not backing Debs.
Yeah.
It's just fucking absurd.
That's interesting how we claim the legacy of two things that are in opposition to one another. I guess it's not, we're not LARPing whether or not we agree with Debs or not. I just think it's funny that we don't counterpose those things.
We probably should, right? And I think that to me is that's the first really big lesson, is that when you have a Communist Labor Party, a Communist Party, and a Socialist Party, and they're all trying to represent the working class of the United States to make a revolution and overthrow capitalism, and they all think the Russian Revolution was great, and they think the Bolsheviks are heroes, and they all want to join the Comintern. Like, part of the reason maybe why we claim the legacy of each is because it's actually the same legacy.
Yeah.
But there are...
I mean, I get it. I understand. Like, I claim opposing legacies... I mean, I guess I don't claim any legacy, which allows me to appreciate opposing legacies.
Yeah, that's right. But there are some differences, right? Like the communists think that the world revolution is imminent because it just happened in Russia, and obviously there's the Bavarian Soviet Republic. Is that the same year? Yeah, that's 1918. The Hungarian Soviet Republic. There's a general strike in Seattle. Strike wave across the steel industry. So there's something like 300,000 workers on strike during this time. But interestingly, they kind of have nothing to do with it because they're too busy forming a communist party and denouncing each other. But they go underground.
Well, and there's no doubt that there could have been some fruits to be harvested from their involvement in this like strike wave. But like I think that we previously put way too much emphasis on the importance of this strike wave. I think the way that we always talked about it before is like the United States was in a pre-revolutionary situation, and if there would have just been some good leadership, then we could have united everything and things would have popped off.
Yeah.
It's the same way that we talk about Germany, which, you know, that's what I study now. And what I'm learning about Germany is that Germany was way worse off than we ever, as Trotskyists, learned it to be. We just assume that if the Social Democrats would have been not bad, then Rosa Luxemburg wouldn't have been killed and we would have communism right now. And it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
It's this Trotskyist idea that just proper leadership is the only thing that's missing, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it is also, it's critical as the founding origin story, the founding myth of American communism as a distinct tendency. Because if you can't make the case that the only reason why 1919 wasn't a great red year in a deeper sense, but it has to do with the misleadership of the Socialist Party executive, if that's not true, then you have to ask why, whether or not there needed to be a Communist Party in the first place. So the Communist Party's underground. They're preparing Bolshevik style, or at least they think so. This is another one of the myths that I think is actually really interesting and worth sort of digging into a little bit. They don't know anything about the Bolsheviks. They just know that the Bolsheviks were non-parliamentarians. But so the people who...
Well, they weren't.
Yeah. That's the way they see it, though. But the people who make up...
I mean, they became that way in a revolutionary situation, but all the way up until then, they weren't.
Yeah, that's... You're a revisionist for saying that.
No. I'm a visionist, dude.
The people who make up the Communist Party are... Philosophically, right? These are the people who think that running in elections is a mistake. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of resources. And that the unions need to be taken over. You need to form, like, you know, they have the dual union strategy. That's also De Leon and the SLP and the reason why everybody hated them back in the 1880s and 90s. And the reason why the Socialist Party came into existence in the first place, to break out of that precise isolation. So... the impossibilist trend, that's what they were called, is what founds the Communist Party. And that matters because they're forced to change by the Communist International. And it's really embarrassing, right? So in the mid-1920s, the Comintern forces the CP above ground and forces them to adopt the position of boring from within the unions, which means participating in the existing trade unions where, you know, the American working class is, rather than trying to create revolutionary unions to compete with them, and basically forces them to adopt more or less all of the positions of the Socialist Party of America.
Right. So the Communist Party starts pulling right.
I mean, that's a way to put it. Sure. I would say that pulling right in the sense of pulling away from the ultra left. Yeah.
From the ultra left positions they had. Right. And pulling right isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
Pulling right from being primitivism is not bad.
Yeah, I mean, unless you regard primitivism as right wing.
Well, I mean, some primitivism is right wing. Yeah.
No, you're right. The Communist Party
actually
is...
primitivism is one of the only instances that proves that horseshoe theory might have some merit.
Yeah, but I do think that's the right way to put it. Basically, the Comintern forces the communists in the United States to moderate their organizational structure, their demands, etc., right? To become relatable.
Right.
And this ties back to one of our earliest episodes where we talked about the Comintern and the workers' government debates. This is happening at the same time.
Right. That was one of our Patreon episodes.
Yeah. This is that same debate. It's like, okay, the revolution is not happening the way that we thought, but there is still a mass workers' movement. So how do we reconnect? You know, how do we... Obviously, the theory of offensive has failed. There aren't going to be other Soviet republics, but maybe there are other ways to get to socialism. So even as far back as like the mid-1920s, that's already the case. So I can't even imagine how embarrassing it must have been to be Louis Freyna or John Reed or, you know, any of these guys that founded the Communist Party, you know, in direct opposition to precisely those things. Running in elections, being an above ground legal party, and working with the existing trade unions. But... it's also pretty clear that the Comintern saved them from absolute irrelevance because they just don't matter up until that point.
Right.
Actually, they don't really matter until the Great Depression.
But they wouldn't have mattered in the Great Depression.
They wouldn't have mattered in the Depression at all. But nevertheless, now we have a communist tendency. And at the time, it's basically identical to the Socialist Party. But it starts to develop. basically because the Comintern intervenes constantly.
At the same time, isn't the Socialist Party sort of pulling left?
Yeah, certainly by the Depression, they are. You know, Debs dies in 26, and they're a little rudderless for a while. And it's a testament to the absolute incoherence and factional struggle inside the Communist Party that the Socialist Party is still the more relevant party in the mid-20s because the Socialist Party doesn't know what to do about anything.
Yeah.
But I do think...
they've got no leadership. They have, like, if I remember correctly, they're just constantly, like, changing positions.
Yeah, they are floundering and they're flailing about.
Yeah.
But there is that moment of the... there's an attempt to build a national farmer labor party. And this right. to me is like the last hope. And this is even more tragic than the split is, you know, the communists, socialists, the regional farmer laborites in places like Minnesota, and also a bunch of mm-hmm. independent trade union and other types of, you know, basically everybody who's looking for a radical third party to represent toilers and producers, broadly defined, farmers, workers, etc.
Right.
So they all participate in the Conference for Progressive Political Action. And that's the last chance, really. So this is like, I think it's 24. So we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of our last chance.
Cool.
The quick version of that story is that they select Robert La Follette, who is a progressive Republican who breaks from the Republican Party. And they all endorse his candidacy, but he doesn't want to actually found a new party. So he gets, 4,831,706 votes in 1924. That's 16% of the vote. And everybody's ecstatic, right?
Damn.
Because that's like,
right.
This is the basis of a new party. So now, and Debs is in favor of this because he sees, basically he's a very old man and he's seen his life's work scattered and, you know, stomped into bits. And this is an opportunity to get the working class back under one banner. So fine, we'll have a communist faction, a socialist faction, and whatever in a national farmer labor party. But it doesn't work out because La Follette doesn't want to found a new party. And communists and socialists still hate each other. And the farmer laborites and the other types of people, ex-populists and trade unionists, whatever, can't figure out what the difference is between the communists and socialists. And so everyone goes back to their corners and decides they'll just lead the revolution on their own. And, you know, that works really well.
And we've been doing that ever
yeah,
since.
Pretty much. But like we were saying, the Great Depression puts the wind in the sails of the Communist Party. Oh, right. They also kick out all the Trotskyists. Forgot about that.
Oh, yeah. There's that.
So the people, some of the founders of the party, right? James Cannon, Max Jackman, Martin Ahburn, people like that, make a faithful decision to back Trotsky in the disputes in the Soviet Party, because it's, you know, the communists basically just, at this point, they just follow the Soviet line, whatever it's going to be. So the Soviet leadership, let's say, quarrels with Trotsky, is the way that Stalin puts it. And the Americans kick out the Trotskyists. So now I guess the party is led by Jay Lovestone, I think.
Yeah.
The Trotskyists are furious. They don't go out to try to form their own party. They form the Communist League of America as an external faction, petitioning for their right to get back into the Communist Party, which is, you know, admirable and disciplined or whatever.
I mean, how do you start a new party when you're barely...
Yeah, it's like 100 people.
How many?
I think...
Like 20-something years out from the Russian Revolution and just been kicked out of the party of Lenin. How do you have the heart to start a new... Like, you have to have hope.
Yeah.
That you and your 100 friends are going to be able to get back in.
Yeah, it's the most inspiring and most infuriating thing about Trotskyism as a tradition. So me and my 100 friends are going to embody the will of history and the masses will just come to us. But it's also not entirely delusional, right? Like, they lead the Minneapolis general strike.
Which is impressive.
Yeah.
Incredibly impressive.
Yeah. They make a name for themselves. They also do a lot to make the Teamsters an important union, like up and down the Midwest. And then they merge with A.J. Musty's Workers' Party, who they basically lead the same kind of strike in a really similar way in Toledo. So this Communist League of America and the Workers' Party merge into the Workers' Party USA. So now I think, like, you know, the Trotskyist line on the family tree is like clearly distinguished from the communist one. They're no longer petitioning to get back in because it's very clear that they're not going to be allowed. In fact, the Communist Party newspapers at the time denounced the Trotskyists for leading the Minneapolis general strike, first because it's definitely guaranteed to lose and they're sowing illusions in the minds of the working class. And then after they win, the communist papers denounce them for not taking the strike further and that they should have, they would have led the revolution if they were real revolutionists. Basically, the Trotskyists at this point are like, okay, these people, they're never going to let us back in. They hate us.
And this is fairly typical sort of like casuistry by Stalinism and has never stopped.
Yeah. This is the...
It's just complete dishonesty and like it's amoralism. It's the ends justify the means no matter what, including no matter how trivial the stupid lie you're telling is.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll see this like a lot of the times. I know you've had to organize with tankies and like the stupid fucking things that they do to maneuver in your little like 12 person group.
Yeah, man, like I'll just
treating everything like it's a life and death revolutionary struggle.
Yeah, like I have just to take one of many examples. I used to have to work often and closely with a guy that it was a proud tanky from a proudly tanky group, one of the many weird small ones that's like a new communist movement holdover. And his method of debating his opponents, sometimes that was me, sometimes it was other people, was to just pretend to misunderstand what they were saying and argue against pieces of their argument that they weren't saying, forcing them to have to constantly clarify themselves until they got frustrated. And he was happy to admit that it was a way of confusing and frustrating and causing disruption and disunity. And I just thought, like, that's a Fed shit is what it is, right? But anyways.
So that's like that's a tanky tactic, whereas like Trotsky's tactic would be like over earnestness and like quoting the words of Lenin and Trotsky like it's the Bible.
Yeah, it's quoting it like it's out of a spell book. If you say it properly, then history will emerge. And but I do think, okay, so the communists deserve credit at this time too. While this is all happening, they're also leading the San Francisco strike. So the three major strikes. This is in 1934, and that's a year of three major strikes. The Musteeites, the Trotskyists, and the communists each lead one.
And that's like, while we are sitting here criticizing these people in hindsight, they're doing things that we could never even imagine doing today.
Yeah, and absolutely. Right? And this is, this is the beginning of the return of industrial unionism, the IWW spirit kind of manifest in a new way. This is the beginning of the CIO. This is the beginning of, this is not yet the Popular Front, but this is when the Communist Party actually has like a horrendous line. This is when everybody who's not a communist is a social fascist.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But it's also a growing party of militant workers who are fighting and winning. And so, like, the average rank and file communist isn't really so much worried about the intricacies of what's happening on the world stage, other than that it's very clear that Mussolini is bad and invading Ethiopia is terrible, and we are opposing that, and Jim Crow is bad, lynching people is bad, the bosses are bad. I guess I'll join the communists. We all would have done so. It's very unlikely that we would have been people who sought out the tiny, numbering in the hundreds, Trotskyist group to join. You know, we probably would have joined the Communist Party. Then they kick out Lovestone. Actually, my dates are all wrong. Whatever. Lovestone is expelled from the CP in 1929, and he creates the Communist Party opposition. These are basically the Bukharin people. This is the American reflection of the break with Bukharin in Russia. And we can get into an enormous amount of detail here. They never go anywhere. They basically fizzle out over time. But also the Socialist Party is doing really well in this period. They're kind of getting the wind back in their sails. Norman Thomas is the leader. He's the only, he's the last significant figure. I think it's 1932. 884,885 votes for Norman Thomas on the Socialist Party ticket.
Damn. Yeah, that's, almost reaching Debs levels.
Yeah, whenever we would go to like these conferences every year and we'd have like, there'd always be one talk about the Socialist Party and Eugene Debs. It's actually kind of criminal to just ignore the 30s. The Socialist Party in the 30s is like, just not a factor because now there are Trotskyists, right? Yeah. So we're not supposed to, whatever.
No, now we're Trotsky fans or Trotskyism fans, and we're following them. That's where we get our inspiration from. You're not allowed to get inspiration from somewhere right. else at the same time.
But then, of course, the Trotskyists go into the Socialist Party because there are so many young workers joining it, and they're taking an increasingly like left-wing position, including, if not outright, like full-throated support for the Soviet Union, at least friendly relations with the Soviet Union, which is, you know,
yeah,
that's pretty good. So the Trotskyists join the Socialist Party of America. Norman Thomas won't let them join as a faction. They make them join individually. So they all organize themselves around a newspaper, the Socialist Appeal, which is where the whole Trotskyist fetish for the newspaper comes from, which, you know, basically at one point it really mattered that you had one. And now I would say it doesn't.
Right.
Right. And then
I remember what I used to save every single one of my Socialist Worker newspapers that I got.
Oh, Jesus.
Because I wanted to have like an archive of them. So I had like hundreds and hundreds of Socialist Worker papers. And all of the ones that we didn't end up selling and that the branch had to buy from the organization, they were all like stacked up in a closet in my house.
What did you do with them?
And when I moved, I just used them to pack.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. I feel like I remember using them for like kindling, starting fires too. Yeah.
Yeah, so the paper does have its uses.
So by the mid-30s, the Communist Party has dropped the social fascism line, and they...
Oh, that's good of them.
Yeah, suddenly...
To drop one of the stupidest and like and most destructive things that has ever been adopted by a left organization.
Yeah, it's inexplicable.
Criminally stupid.
The only way to explain it is that they just didn't have any independence, so they just did whatever Moscow told them. And that's it, really.
Right, but on behalf of Moscow, it was criminal stupidity. Yeah. It basically ended up, that decision, not even in the long run, in the medium-term run, ended up with Germany's communists in concentration camps.
Yeah. That's still not the end of the social fascism line, though, right? It's not until the Spanish Civil War breaks out that
right.
the Republican forces, which include, let's see, there's the Communist Party of Spain, there's the Spanish Socialist Party, there's the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, the famous POUM, the PUM, and mm-hmm. also the CNTFAI, the Anarcho-Syndicalist Trade Union Federation. And that's all in addition to the other kinds of, you know, Republicans, including the pro-capitalist ones. So the communists take up the popular front line, and they look around for progressive forces to unite with. And actually, this is probably the real last chance, although maybe that chance is never really there, because at this point, loyalty to Moscow means they're never going to follow through. But you have the Communist Party drifting a little bit further to the right, so to speak, and the Socialist Party drifting a little bit further to the left. But they don't exactly meet in the middle, and, you know, the two wings are not really ever partners. And it basically stays that way. And then we have the Second World War. So, yeah, this is the period of, like, communism at its zenith. This is the second golden age of American socialism. And this time the torch is firmly passed, because the Communist Party, after adopting the popular front line, which makes them no longer in direct competition. Well, they're still in competition. They're not in direct conflict with everybody else on the left. And they really kind of take up the banner of the defenders and extenders of democracy. So they compare Jim Crow to the Third Reich. They basically invent the BDS tactic by organizing boycotts of German goods and also of Italian goods. They create the Washington and Lincoln battalions and send people to Spain to fight and die in defense of the Spanish Republic against Franco and Mussolini and Hitler. This is like a deeply heroic period.
Right.
And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that at this time in history, the rank-and-file communists, and this is worldwide, right, is the heart of humanity. There's a growing sense that there's a future that is one of peace and prosperity and a future of darkness and horror, and the communists are going to be the ones that define the future in the positive. And that lasts all the way up until the end of the Second World War, really. But the beginning of...
Well, I mean, there's dark spots in there, like the... Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Oh yeah, I guess we shouldn't skip over that one.
No, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the fact that the Russian communists turn over all of the, or turn over a number of, I don't know about all of them, a number of the communist leadership from Germany that's taking refuge in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
to be executed in German concentration camps.
Yeah, that's true, right. They sign an accord with the Third Reich, and then they invade Poland and split it in the middle. It's the last great partition of Poland. All the previous ones were done by people who didn't call themselves communists.
Right.
They also invade...
And then there's the Katyn massacre, you know, and then they invade Finland.
Yeah. Well, right, so...
There's
world communism as a movement, I think, like... Yeah, I think, first of all, we have to own all of this. This is all part of our history. But the rank-and-file communist is the heart of humanity.
There we go.
The person...
Okay, yeah, I will definitely agree with that.
The proletarian tossed out of work during the Depression who decides to organize a sit-in for not even just a severance pay, but to keep the factory running and simultaneously gives lectures about the danger of fascism and the need to for black and white workers to embrace each other. Because that's the real spirit of America. It's a really hard thing to even think of as actually existing today. But they signed the No Strike Pledge once the war starts. So the AFL and the CIO, the two labor federations, their leadership are all in favor of, well, you know, once World War II breaks out, all the trade union leaders are in favor of a No Strike Pledge in the war industries. And the communists agree with it because they say, like, if you're striking in a war industry, you're undermining the war effort, and that means you're defending Hitler. The Trotskyists don't sign, they don't support a no strike pledge, and actually, like, a lot of they gain a bigger audience than ever because they're the communists who will still strike.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the Smith Act passed in order to enable the federal government to prosecute dangerous radicals, ostensibly people with fascistic sympathies, right?
Yep.
And so that's primarily used at this time, this is 1941, against the leadership of the Socialist Workers' Party, to much applause by the communist leadership, who really, really hate the Trotskyists and, you know...
Right, I mean, because the line being pushed by Moscow is that Trotsky is actually a fascist agent.
Right. He's in league with Hitler, and, you know, if he wasn't in league with Hitler, then why wouldn't they sign a no-strike pledge, you know? So.
Yep. And there are still fucking morons that regurgitate that line today.
Yeah.
In defiance of all evidence to the contrary.
Well, that's because the internet was a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely it was. I saw on Facebook the other day a guy who was saying that, like, referring to... Well, he said that Trotsky was a stooge of the CIA... Or not the CIA, of the American Foreign Intelligence.
I mean, that holds just as much water, honestly.
Well, I mean, at least with the fascist allegations, there's a show trial that convicted him in absentia.
Yeah, that's true.
At least there are accusations. Where the fuck did this guy get this one from?
It's really cool when you know somebody who is the is the repository of secret knowledge.
Yeah, dude, that's like basically like the Aleister Crowley of asinine, tanky conspiracy theories about Trotskyism.
Yeah, well, it really is, like, to me, this is a sign of the immense weakness of the U.S. left and actually of the historical failure of Trotskyism, that this can reemerge, that, like, third period ultra-Stalinism has an audience again on the internet because there isn't anything tangible and real. But the Socialist Workers' Party, which we didn't even mention, right, we have to backtrack a little bit. So we keep referring to the Trotskyists, but last time we mentioned them, they were the Communist League of America, and then they merged and with Musty's people, and they became the Workers' Party, and then they went into the Socialist Party, and they were the Socialist Appeal faction. But in protest of allowing the Trotskyists into the party, and in protest of increasing friendly relations between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, a right-wing split out of the Socialist Party happens, and they create the Social Democratic Federation. And...
Cool.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It's probably this one of the splits that probably should have happened. But everyone hates the Trotskyists in the Socialist Party because they're obnoxious and they're always talking about the world revolution and trying to push the if only we had the right leadership we could have the revolution line. And also,
guess what?
It turns out to not be true.
Trotskyists never stop being obnoxious and pushing the world revolution line. It just never happens. Yeah.
It's a perennial feature. It's baked into the DNA of the movement.
And this is self-criticism because we were once Trotsky.
Speaking as one of those people who used to do that, I feel like I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Norman Thomas.
I have a friend who's Trotskyist, so I can say that.
So Norman Thomas wants the Social Democratic Federation back because it's a bunch of trade union leaders, people who are important in, I think, the Garment Workers Union, and then a couple of other important unions, and doesn't really like working with the Trotskyists. And so between those two things, for Thomas, this is a no-brainer. We'll kick out the Trotskyists, and we'll bring, we'll sort of court the SDF. Of course, the Social Democratic Federation doesn't go back into the Socialist Party until the 50s. So, whoops. Also, the Trotskyists turn out to be very popular among a certain section of the Socialist Party, namely all the young people. So when they kick kick out the Socialist Appeal faction, they also
kick out the entire future of the party.
Yeah, the entire Young People's Socialist League leaves with the Appeal faction. And that is more or less the end of the Socialist Party as a meaningful institution in this history. They only do one other thing in the 70s, and that's break up into three pieces. So if the 1919 split was, you know, half pro-Bolshevik types who are obnoxious and think they're going to take over the party and kick everybody out who doesn't agree with them, and the other half is the existing executive who kicks them out first, you know, preemptively, but also loses two-thirds of the membership of the party in the process. The 1930, what year is it? Is it 35, 36, whatever? The mid-30s expulsion of the Trotskyists out of the Socialist Party is extremely farcical in that it basically replicates that, but on a smaller scale. Anyways, the Socialist Appeal faction plus the Young People's Socialist League found the Socialist Workers' Party, and that party still exists today, too. So, like, from here on out, when we say the Trotskyists, that's what we mean.
The Socialist Workers' Party at this time, how many members do they have?
More than 1,000, but I don't know how many more.
Okay, that's like peak. That's the biggest a Trotskyist organization ever is able to get, is around 1,000 members.
Well, except for in the 60s, the SWP is the largest, at least working class socialist group in the country. They actually have 6,000 members in the late 60s.
Oh, wow. Yeah, okay, I guess I forgot about that.
Yeah, but that's the peak of American Trotskyism is the 60s. Even though the really cool stuff is all from the 30s and 40s. So anyways, the SP blows its foot off. There's now, for all intents and purposes, the chart is more, it's the Communist Party and the Socialist Workers' Party. And going into right. The Second World War now that we've backtracked, going into the Second World War, the Communist Party is, having already had the experience of sending volunteers to fight very heroically in Spain. And, you know, if you go to Spain today, there are memorials to the international brigades all over the place. They, having had that experience and seeing what happens when you lose, and now seeing they couldn't ward off a Second World War, and they see it's happening now, right? The Third Reich invades the Soviet Union, the Empire of Japan has already been at war in China, and then they bomb Pearl Harbor, so the war officially happens, and the Communist Party is all in. The role of a communist is to win the war against fascism. So either as a soldier or, you know, in the production of what the soldiers need, that's the task. And you might think that the Trotskyist line, given that they don't like the No Strike Pledge, you would think that they would have a different one about the war, but they don't. They adopt what they call the proletarian military strategy, where members of the Socialist Workers Party are meant to go into the U.S. Armed Forces and, yeah, fight the war against fascism. But unlike the communists, they're also meant to recruit and agitate among the soldiers, just like the Bolsheviks did during the First World War. And that nets them nothing.
Well, yeah, that's an incoherent position. Yeah, yeah, that's ridiculous.
The only, as far as I'm aware, this is the only thing that really, the only byproduct of the proletarian military policy, other than the death of individual SWP members as soldiers, there was one of these guys was on a bomber crew and assisted in the radicalization of one Howard Zinn.
Oh, yeah, I knew
so
that story.
That's the proletarian military policy's only success, as far as I can tell, is that Howard Zinn wrote People's History of the United States. So, and then the Socialist Party has kind of a pacifistic but kind of incoherent line, because they also agree that fascism is the greatest threat to humanity, but they can't countenance going into war because their leader, Norman Thomas, is a Presbyterian minister and, as an actual Christian, thinks going to war is bad.
A big improvement, that would be a big improvement for like a majority of Christians that exist in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
If
Christians love war these days.
They
can't get enough of that shit.
Awesome. I wish more Christians were like Norman Thomas.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the way, I think it's appropriate to look at the Second World War as the end of the, or the closing out of the Second World War and the dawn of the Cold War as the end of that whole first wave of American socialist history. From the end of the Civil War to the end of the Second World War, socialism is a mass movement of the working class, embodied in mass parties like the Socialist Party of America and the Communist Party USA, and in trade unions like whether it's the IWW or the CIO or in the AFL and in at least some of the affiliated unions of the AFL. And the Second World War changes all that. Not all on its own, but the honeymoon period of the Popular Front and the mass popularity of socialism a second time around in the form of the Earl Browder's Communism is 20th Century Americanism, that all goes away. And I think that the next period, the one that I think we're still in, all of its roots are fully, all of those seeds are now planted here. And I think that the next period basically begins with the use of the Smith Act to imprison leaders of the Communist Party. And this time, there's nobody around to defend them.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be awaiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting, talk it over, speak your mind, decide to do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool, but you can always tell a stool, though, well, that's a fact. He's got a yaller streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool. He'll always get along on what he takes out of blind men's cups. You got a union now and you're sitting pretty. Put some of the boys on the steering committee. The boss won't listen when one guy squawks, but he's got to listen when the union talks. He'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose they're working you so hard it's just outrageous and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling mighty slick, cause he thinks he's got your union lick. Well, he looks out the window and what does he see but a thousand pickets, and they all agree he's a bastard. Unfair! Slave driver. Bet he beats his wife. Now, boys, you come to the hardest time. The boss will try to bust your picket line. He'll call out the police, the National Guard. They'll tell you it's a crime to have a union card. They'll raid your meeting. They'll hit you on the head. They'll call every one of you a damn red unpatriotic. Japanese spies. Sabotaging national defense. But out at Ford, here's what they found. And out at Vulti, here's what they found. And out at Alice Chalmers, here's what they found. And down at Bethlehem, here's what they found. That if you don't let red baiting break you up, and if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, and if you don't let vigilantes break you up, and if you don't let race hatred break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.